kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me in my life.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. If you want to watch today's program, just go to Ustream channel and search for Gary Null. Today, no guests, because we have a lot of commentaries. I've set aside about 25 minutes for a special exploration from a TED conference on education. Each day this week, we will have different presenters from 15 minutes to 22 minutes. If time permits, we will then take calls so you can offer your input. So that's the second half of our program. Of course, we begin with the latest on health and nutrition, including how ice from fast food restaurants has more bacteria than toilet water. Wow. And I was just got a haircut, and just a few moments ago, just walked from the barbershop, and they offer some lemon water with ice. Well, that sounds nice, but I watched them make it. Dirty hands, cutting up a lemon that had not been washed, and then taking, with those dirty hands, ice, and putting it in, and then putting some water in. Think of how many people today are going to be exposed to all forms of bacteria and don't know it. Now just imagine going into a restaurant and having some water with ice. We'll get with that. I had a debate once, a personal and private debate, for 6 hours on a transnational flight with Robert Atkins. Robert was a friend of mine for a long time. We would go out and debate together, and we had social time. And this debate was about the dangers of his diet. Now, a new study on how high-fat diets, that's his diet, high-protein, high-fat, promotes intestinal cancer. I'm a big believer in grapes. Eating organic grapes, the skin, the seed, and because it has resveratrol, a very important substance, thousands of articles are now out on resveratrol and why it's good for you. I'll show you the latest of how it can boost mitochondria, which is your energy in your body. Plants in the office make workers happier and more productive, and a lot more on health and healing. Then, from our environment, I'm going to take a look at California water infrastructure on the verge of a historical collapse. And writing in the Washington Post, Jacob Wurick draws attention to what many scientists say is an unprecedented collapse of California's vast water infrastructure. Now, they have the most elaborate system of canals and reservoirs and wells in the country, and yet that's what transfers water from the mountains and other areas to the Central Valley. Now, though the state contains some 27 million acres of cropland, this system is now failing. So what is happening? Will it get better? Who's going to be impacted? What we should know about it? Because from California, then you have Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Utah, South Dakota, Wyoming, Nevada, which will be virtually unsustainable within 10 years, and other places. And to give you an idea of how serious it is, I did my own original investigative report and found 1,214 communities in Texas alone that are either out of water or running out of water, and that amounts to 6.1 million people. So you would think that with 6.1 million people going to be either low or out of water, someone should do something. No one's doing anything. So what's that mean? It means that those who can exploit it will do. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some of the big multinational people, the hedge fund people, the equity partnerships coming in, buying up water rights, and then charging exorbitant amounts of money for that. You think you have nothing to hide. Hence, the average American is not concerned about what the police do in their searching and stopping people and taking their DNA and without any provocation. And as long as it's the blacks and Latinos that are being stopped and searched, the rest of America says, so what? Turn the channel. Well, you better pay attention, because we've gone beyond being a full-functioning fascist state, a totalitarian country without anything resembling true democracy, to where we're virtually on the cusp of being a full-fledged police state. We've already militarized it. We already have the for-profit prisons. We already have the for-profit private debtors' prisons. We've already had some test cases to see how this will be dealt with. So I'll tell you why. You better take a look at the ways that you, every single person in the United States, adult, could be convicted today of a crime. Crimes you're not even aware on the books. We'll deal with it. Let's begin. I have been, my entire career, opposed to high-fat diets. If you understand the biochemistry of what happens when you eat fat, just to give you one example, and I did this in the lab, my statements are not based upon theoretical hypothesis. I've actually done the science. You give a person a fast food meal, an average meal, nothing extra, just what they would eat if they went into a fast food restaurant. We did this. And then an hour later, you take a sample of their blood. You take a sample before they eat it. You take a sample afterwards. You would never recognize it was the same person's blood. In the blood before, it may not have enough oxygen, so it may be darker. The more oxygen you have, the brighter it gets, the more vitamin E, the more trimethylglycine, the brighter it is. But when you're tired, fatigued, you have a bad diet, it almost is turgid. It looks dark. Not good. Now you add that fast food meal, you have all these white streaks. That's the fat. And that fat can collect platelets. And that can form clots. And that's why high fast food meals are associated with an increased risk of stroke. You also have the problem of high sodium in a high fast food meal. And you have the problem of both acrylamides from baked goods and heterocyclic amines from proteins. So quite simply, eating a fast food meal, you are really challenging your health. You are doing damage. You just don't know when you'll be given the check to pay for it, when the heart attack or stroke will come. But it will. And those who are the most arrogant and defiant, I wonder if there's any moment when they're at the cash out point where they realize maybe they should have been a little more humble, a little more progressive in their thinking. But in America right now, we are a gluttonous nation for about 80% of people. The bigger the meal, the more we like it. The more salty, the more protein. We don't care where the cow was killed, how it was raised. We don't care if it suffered or not. We want our food, and we want it now. We want a lot of it, and we want it salty, and we want it French fried, and we want everything in the world on it. So we want the pork. And I just saw a program where they put two eggs and two pieces of Spam and two pieces of bacon and two hamburger patties and two giant rolls. Okay, because that's what people want. It's a very popular restaurant. But there's no irony of what are the consequences to the way we eat. This is the latest in medical news today. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature, which is considered the finest science publication in the world. Quote, high-fat diets may promote the growth of tumors in the intestine by causing changes to the microbial community in the gut. Demonstrates a study in Nature this week. So, obesity and high-fat diets have been linked with gastrointestinal cancers. And so that is just one more thing. Now, here's what we found. We did a study at the Institute of Applied Biology on some 100 individuals on transit time, meaning how long does it take food to go through the digestive process? Well, that was a matter of which foods you ate, how much liquid you had. Did you drink with the meal or after the meal? Did you flood the stomach? In effect, you're full of food in the stomach, but then you're thirsty because so much of it has sodium in it, so the body automatically turns on the mechanism in the brain that tells you drink to thin the blood. Because when you start having that much sodium, it's terrible at the cellular level. You start leaching sodium inside the cell, potassium outside the cell, and it should be just the opposite. Potassium should be in the cell, sodium should be outside. And this adversely affects what is called the sodium-potassium pump at the cell. But it also leads to edema, swelling in the ankles and the face and the arms. It also leads to high blood pressure. It also leads to stroke. So just imagine how many different risk factors there are in just having too much salt. Now add in fat, and here's what fat does when you eat it. If you're eating the average fat, saturated fat, trans fat, it slows down digestion like a traffic jam going from 60 miles an hour to 5 miles an hour. And the more fat you have, the slower peristalsis, the wave-like rhythmic movement that takes food through your intestine. The more food you have in your stomach, the less proper digestion you get, the less absorption of the actual nutrients in there, but the body doesn't have a problem absorbing glucose, sugar, so that you will get, and fat. But it does have a problem getting some of the essential nutrients that are locked inside the fiber, and hence proper chewing of a food breaks down the fiber, and then taking your time eating, having smaller meals. The smaller amount of food in the stomach, the better the digestion. The faster the digestion, the more fiber you have, the faster the digestion. And you want good digestion. We measured some people having 96 hours transit time. That means from the time they eat to the time they vacate it, it's 96 hours. That means that the food and its chemicals, both that was added to it, coloring agent, preservatives, additives, the type of fat you had, like arachidonic fats from animal proteins, and the lack of fiber, it sets you up to have polyps in the intestine, itises, ileitis, colitis, diverticulitis, and inflammation, and that leads to precancerous lesions in the intestine, or in time, colorectal cancer, which is a major cancer. So quite simply, we have colorectal cancer because of how we eat. So if you eat smaller meals with higher fiber and you take your time and you thoroughly masticate and digest your food and don't drink liquids during the meal, if you do, you confuse the stomach by diluting hydrochloric acid and the different enzymes like pepsin and lipase. And so the body starts to produce more. And then you have so much food and water in the stomach that the body then starts to dump it. It opens up a flap called the pyloric sphincter flap, and that then dumps partially digested material into your intestine. Now, there's no way of really breaking the rest of that food down to where it should be. You can break down some of the fats with bile, and there are some enzymes that are released, but by and large, whatever goes in there is pretty much going to stay that composition. You want it to be like a soup, a thick soup. You don't want it to be chunky, because those chunks are not going to be broken down, especially if they're proteins. So then you get down in the intestine or the colon, and it is so damaged that particles of food are leached into the bloodstream through what is called leaky gut, and then your body attacks that as if it's a foreign agent instead of a nutrient, and then that causes a hyper-immune vigilant state, which virtually burns out your immune system. So that's why something that we take for granted, eating, there is so much more to it to be healthy from what we eat. Anyhow, Atkins never changed his opinion. He just believed that, okay, so people might get sick on my diet, so I'll give them some vitamins. I said, that doesn't change anything. And I told him Do you want to see how many of your patients come to see me because they got sick on your diet? But he was indifferent to it. And unfortunately, his is still the more popular diet in the world today, or in America at least. Now, a nutrient that we should pay attention to is from grapes. Now, you'll get the best advantage if you get this from drinking grape juice, not diluted, or drinking grape concentrate, or having grape powder. Ironic that you get the least amount from drinking red wine. In fact, one teaspoon of resveratrol, just a teaspoon, could be equivalent to about 300 glasses of wine. So you really got to understand that the red wine is not the best place to get it. It's the least place to get it. But in any case, there's a lot of good research on resveratrol. And the latest is coming to us from the Journal of Food Science, University in Japan, or China. And it says the following, quote, supplementing red wine polyphenol resveratrol may counter the detrimental effects of a high-fat diet, including restoring mitochondrial function. Quote, from the article, supplementation with resveratrol stimulated mitochondrial biogenesis and restored mitochondrial function activities of TREGs. These beneficial resveratrol-induced changes in mitochondrial biogenesis are consistent with the previous studies in which resveratrol increased the number of mitochondria, shifted the physiology of mice on a high-fat diet towards that of mice on a standard diet, and significantly increased their survival, quote. Now, what does this mean in just lay language? It means that there are certain ways to expend our energy to extend our lifespan, and resveratrol is a powerful polyphenol. It's antifungal, and it is just a terrific bioactive compound. And resveratrol can activate a gene called SIRT1. The yeast equivalent was SIRT2, which is also activated during calorie restriction, which means that your body, when it has resveratrol, acts as if it has less calories. You also can protect your mitochondria, the energy factories, so your energy factories work better. So, in all levels, it's good for you. So, have your grapes, your grape juice, and resveratrol. Now, this is from Prevent Disease. Franchises of McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, quote, have been found to use ice that was found to contain up to 19 times the amount of bacteria that the acceptable limit for drinking water. The amount of bacteria in ice cubes used for carbonated beverages at one Kentucky Fried Chicken location was reportedly found to be 1,300% higher than in toilet water in a lab test. According to the Wall Street Journal, Kentucky Fried Chicken issued a public apology following the China Central Television report. McDonald's and Kung Fu announced investigations into the matter. So, better pay attention. Now, how could all that bacteria get there? Well, there's several ways. First, it can be in the pipes itself. You may have clean hands. You may have sanitary ways of touching ice and even making ice. But if there's anything in that condenser, if there's anything in your freezing unit that has bacteria on it, with every ice cube you make, it's going to be dirty ice. So people don't think, well, when was the last time they checked the plumbing, the actual mechanical part of anything? And the answer is never. They didn't even think about it. So my suggestion is that if you have a refrigerator that makes ice cubes, clean it. Just clean the unit. And I never, ever get water or ice, even drink out of a glass in a restaurant. Nor do I ever eat a salad in a restaurant, nor any raw food ever, especially from raw food restaurants, because I know the hygiene and I'm not trusting it. Plants in offices make workers happier. This is medical news published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. This was done at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, and University of Queensland in Australia. Staff working in offices designed to be lean and devoid of greenery are happier and more productive than those environments are enriched with plants. And this is the largest field study of its kind. It's not the first study showing that the more green that you have in your office and home, the better it is for you. The better your mood, the healthier it is, because green plants absorb carbon dioxide and other pollutants in the air and therefore give you oxygen, which is clean. So they're a perfect air filter. And a lot of people have very Spartan offices. They're a little boxy. There's really no aesthetics to them. So if you have more interesting and aesthetically pleasing environments, and if they're more green, you're going to be happier, work better. So it's a simple message, but it's important, and we should do the same thing for our homes. Is the cell phone becoming an object of addiction? This is from Baylor University. Quote, the word addiction is commonly associated with alcohol and drugs, but a new study by researchers from Baylor University in Waco, Texas, suggests a new form of dependency is becoming an increasing concern, cell phone addiction. The study of high school students found that 60% say they may be addicted to their cell phones, and some say they become highly agitated if it is not nearby. Furthermore, the research team, led by Dr. James Roberts, found that college students spend an average of 9 hours a day using their cell phones. Let me repeat that. 9 hours a day on their cell phones. Now, how many hours on their computer? Where's that leave time for a life or study or real recreation or relating? Quote, that's astonishing, says Professor Roberts. As cell phones function increase, addictions to the seemingly indispensable piece of technology become an increasing realistic possibility. Quote, cell phones may wind up being an escape mechanism from their classrooms. For some, cell phones in class may provide a way to cheat. You think? And that's the latest on health and healing. Now I'm going to share something on the farms, because I believe that what we should be doing is forming small groups, maybe 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 people, no more than that, because it's a little unwieldy if you get too much, and start getting your own water projects going, where you have quality water that's not near a hydrofracking and not near a nuclear power plant, and where you have a water collective, meaning you own the property, you have your own water rights, you bring up the water from a well, and you also make it available at a very reasonable price, less than the market, so people can save, and therefore it's coming from a spiritual place, not a greed place, not a manipulate place. And so that way, those who don't have wells and are on county water, which are most people, will be able to get quality water at less than what they're paying, and you will then have a permanent source of water for the members of your water co-op. And because you're not using it industrially, you're not depleting it from its natural source, but it's easy to test water to see what the mineral level is, the bacterial levels are, and once you know that you have good, clean water, then you have one of the most important resources in the future. And for those who cannot afford to load up on junk, silver, and gold, having water in the future, mark my words, will be one of the most important assets you can have. This is from California. They don't seem to be getting any message. It's positive. Quote, from Natural News, water is increasingly hard to come by in drought-stricken California, where many farmers are struggling to get enough water just to pay the bills. But the situation in the Golden State is far worse than many people realize. According to new reports, as underground aquifers that take decades to recharge are being sucked dry, and water infrastructure has long sustained the agriculture-growing regions of the state, continue to collapse. according to the report that was, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, was that was published in the Washington Post by journalist Joby Warwick, many of California's underground aquifers, which are typically drawn upon as a last resort when all else fails. And what's all else? All else is simply the Sierra Nevada mountain range. That's where cold winters bring lots of snow. They pack feet upon feet of snow on a mountain. Then in the spring, as the weather warms, layers of that water begin to, of ice and snow begin to melt. And that creates the runoff waters that go into the creeks and streams and estuaries and into the canal. And that canal, which is over 450 miles, takes it throughout the state. And then there's allocations, depending upon the Central Valley and other areas, so you can get water to the heartland. And that's what makes California so prosperous in its agriculture. It has water. That's diminished. In fact, so little snow happened in the last 2 years that whole municipalities were no longer in farms around those municipalities, like the cantaloupe capital of America. It went dry. It's got 11,000 people there now, but there's no water for them, and they don't have the money to dig real deep wells to hope to find some aquifer down there. So you could see a shrinking over the next 10 years of California agriculture by 50%. That's 5-0. That would be devastating economically. You're looking at billions and billions of dollars lost because they don't have the water. Isn't it interesting? Something so simple as water and its mismanagement and not looking ahead and making political decisions, which are the only ones they seem capable of making in California, instead of being honest and realistic. And so now those aquifers are all that they have. And the aquifers have dropped by as much as 100 feet. That's an unprecedented decline. Even if the drought suddenly ended, it would take at least 50 years to 100 years to recharge some of those aquifers. Quote, a well-managed basin is used like a reservoir bank, reserve bank, said a professor emeritus of carbon economics at University of California, Davis. And it said that that an estimated 5.1 million acre-feet loss of water this year from California underground reservoirs, a volume the size of Lake Shasta, the state's largest water reservoir. Quote, we're acting like the super rich who have so much money they don't need to balance this checkbook. But for many farmers, it's bad. They either have to pull the water now to save their crops or face potential bankruptcy and the loss of their farms. And because of the immense scarcity of water this year, 60% of California is now recorded as being at the highest level of drought, dubbed exceptional. It's the highest level there is. Many farmers didn't even receive a share from the infrastructure of water. Zero water. None. Not a drop. One such farmer is Joe Caracancho, who grows rice in Willows, California. The 71-year-old lost 25% of his usual water allotment this year, and he's considered lucky, since some farmers receive no water at all, and it's now struggling to make payroll. He is also having to make payments on a $500,000 rice harvester that, despite the water losses, still costs the same every month. Quote, I have 25% less production, but no one is giving me a 25% break in my bills. Agriculture is by far the largest water consumer in the state, representing more than 40% of California water usage. Even with about 35 million residents, California's urban areas only account for 9% of overall water usage, which is minimal in the larger scheme of things. But state lawmakers are moving to impose tighter water restrictions, including a $7.5 million bond measure that, if passed this fall, would expand the state's reservoir system and improve water recycling. Quote, we've reached a tipping point where the surface water is no longer enough, yet there are increasing demands from both agriculture and the environment. So, California, for the very rich, you'll be able to afford to make the wells. For everyone else, you won't. California is not sustainable for the future. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a brief break, come back, and we're going to go directly from the break into a TED Talk on education that I think you'll find stimulating, and it's really original. Please stay with us. And by the way, tonight, 7 o'clock on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I have three of the finest minds in America talking about how the rest of the world perceives the United States and why. You won't want to miss that.
Going to be the future of learning. I do have a plan, but in order for me to tell you what that plan is, I need to tell you a little story which kind of sets the stage. I tried to look at where did the kind of learning we do in schools, where did it come from? And, you know, you can look far back into the past, but if you look at present-day schooling the way it is, it's quite easy to figure out where it came from. It came from about 300 years ago. And it came from the last and the biggest of the empires on this planet. Imagine trying to run the show, trying to run the entire planet without computers, without telephones, with data handwritten on pieces of paper and traveling by ships. But the Victorians actually did it. What they did was amazing. They created a global computer made up of people. It's still with us today. It's called the bureaucratic administrative machine. In order to have that machine running, you need lots and lots of people. They made another machine to produce those people, the school. The schools would produce the people who would then become parts of the bureaucratic administrative machine. They must be identical to each other. They must know three things. They must have good handwriting, because the data is handwritten. They must be able to read. And they must be able to do multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction in their head. They must be so identical that you could pick one up from New Zealand and ship them to Canada, and he would be instantly functional. The Victorians were great engineers. They engineered a system that was so robust that it's still with us today. Continuously producing identical people for a machine that no longer exists. The empire is gone. So what are we doing with that design that produces these identical people? And what are we going to do next, if we ever are going to do anything else with it? So that's a pretty strong comment there. I said schools as we know them now, they're obsolete. I'm not saying they're broken. It's quite fashionable to say that the education system's broken. It's not broken. It's wonderfully constructed. It's just that we don't need it anymore. It's outdated. What's the kind of jobs that we have today? Well, the clerks are the computers. They're there in thousands in every office. And you have people who guide those computers to do their clerical jobs. Those people don't need to be able to write beautifully by hand. They don't need to be able to multiply numbers in their heads. They do need to be able to read. In fact, they need to be able to read discerningly. Well, that's today. But we don't even know what the jobs of the future are going to look like. We know that people will work from wherever they want, whenever they want, in whatever way they want. How is present-day schooling going to prepare them for that world? Well, I bumped into this whole thing completely by accident. I used to teach people how to write computer programs in New Delhi 14 years ago. And right next to where I used to work, there was a slum. And I used to think, how on earth are those kids ever going to learn to write computer programs, or are they? Should they not? At the same time, we also had lots of parents, rich people, who had computers, and who used to tell me, you know, my son, I think he's gifted, because, you know, he does wonderful things with computers. And my daughter, oh, surely she's, you know, extra intelligent, and so on. So I suddenly figured that how come all the rich people are having these extraordinary gifted children? What did the poor do wrong? I made a hole in the boundary wall of the slum next to my office, and I stuck a computer inside it just to see what would happen if I gave a computer to children who never would have one, didn't know any English, didn't know what the internet was. The children came running in, it was 3 feet off the ground, and they said, what is this? And I said, yeah, but it's, you know, I don't know. So they said, why have you put it there? I said, just like that. And they said, can we touch it? I said, if you wish to. And I went away. About 8 hours later, we found them browsing and teaching each other how to browse. So I said, but that's impossible. Because, you know, how is it possible? They don't know anything. My colleague said, no, it's a simple solution. One of your students must have been passing by, showed them how to use the mouse. So I said, yeah, that's possible. So I repeated the experiment. I went 300 miles out of Delhi into a really remote village where the chances of a passing software development engineer was very little. I repeated the experiment there. There was no place to stay, so I stuck my computer in, I went away, came back after a couple of months, found kids playing games on it. When they saw me, they said, we want a faster processor and a better mouse. So I said, how on earth do you know all this? And they said something very interesting to me. In an irritated voice, they said, you've given us a machine that works only in English, so we had to teach ourselves English in order to use it. That's the first time as a teacher that I heard the word teach ourselves said so casually. Here's a short glimpse from those years. That's the first day at the hole in the wall. On your right is an 8-year-old. To his left is his student. She is 6. And he's teaching her how to browse. Then on to the, other parts of the country. I repeated this over and over again, getting exactly the same results everywhere. An 8-year-old telling his elder sister what to do. And finally, a girl explaining in Marathi what it is and said there's a processor inside. So I started publishing. I published everywhere. I wrote down and measured everything. And I said, in 9 months, a group of children left alone with a computer in any language would reach the same standard as an office secretary in the West. I'd seen it happen over and over and over again. But I was curious to know, what else would they do if they could do this much? I started experimenting with other subjects. Among them, for example, pronunciation. There's one community of children in southern India whose English pronunciation was really bad. And they needed good pronunciation because that would improve their jobs. I gave them a speech-to-text engine in a computer. And I said, keep talking into it until it types what you say. Okay. They did that. And watched a little bit of this.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
The reason I end it with that the face of this young lady over there is because I suspect many of you know her. She's now joined a call center in Hyderabad and may have tortured you about your credit card bills. in a very clear English accent. So then people said, well, how far will it go? Where does it stop? I decided I would destroy my own argument by creating an absurd proposition. I made a hypothesis, a ridiculous hypothesis. Tamil is a South Indian language, and I said, can Tamil-speaking children in a South Indian village learn the biotechnology of DNA replication in English from a street-side computer? And I said, I'll measure them, they'll get a zero, I'll spend a couple of months, I'll leave it for a couple of months, I'll go back, they'll get another zero. I'll go back to the lab and say, we need teachers. I found a village, it was called Kali Kuppam in southern India. I put in hole in the wall computers there, downloaded all kinds of stuff from the internet about DNA replication, most of which I didn't understand. The children came rushing and said, what's all this? So I said, it's very topical, very important. It's all in English. So they said, how can we understand such big English words and, you know, diagrams and chemistry? So by now, I had developed a new pedagogical method, so I applied that. I said, I haven't the foggiest idea. And anyway, I'm going away. So I left them for a couple of months. They'd got a zero. I gave them a test. I came back after 2 months and the children trooped in and said, we've understood nothing. So I said, well, I mean, what did I expect? So I said, okay, but how long did it take you before you decided that you can't understand anything? So they said, we haven't given up. We look at it every single day. So I said, what? You don't understand these screens and you keep staring at it for 2 months. What for? So a little girl, who you'll see just now, she raised her hand and she says to me in broken Tamil and English, she said, well, apart from the fact that improper replication of the DNA molecule causes disease, we haven't understood anything else. So I tested them. I got an educational impossibility, 0 to 30% in 2 months in the tropical heat under with their computer under the tree in a language that they didn't know, doing something that's a decade ahead of their time. Absurd. But I had to follow the Victorian norm. 30% is a fail. How do I get them to pass? I have to get them 20 more marks. I couldn't find a teacher. What I did find was a friend that they had, a 22-year-old girl who was an accountant, and she played with them all the time. So I asked this girl, can you help them? So she says, absolutely not. I didn't have science in school. I have no idea what they're doing under that tree all day long. I can't help you. I said, I'll tell you what, use the method of the grandmother. So she says, what's that? I said, stand behind them. Whenever they do anything, you just say, well, wow, I mean, how did you do that? What's the next page? Gosh, when I was your age, I could have never done that. I mean, you know what grannies do. So she did that for 2 more months. The scores jumped to 50%. Kali Kuppam had caught up with my control school in New Delhi, a rich private school with a trained biotechnology teacher. When I saw that graph, I knew there is a way to level the playing field. Here's Kali Kuppam.
Neuron cell death
and
communication.
I got the camera angle wrong in that one. It's just amateur stuff. But what she was saying, as you could make out, was about neurons. But her hands were like that, and she was saying, neurons communicate. At 12. So what are jobs going to be like? Well, we know what they're like today. What's learning going to be like? We know what it's like today, children poring over with their mobile phones on the one hand and then reluctantly going to school to pick up their books with the other hand. What will it be tomorrow? Could it be that we don't need to go to school at all? Could it be that at the point in time when you need to know something, you can find out in 2 minutes? Could it be, a devastating question, a question that was framed for me by Nicholas Negroponte, could it be that we are heading towards or maybe in a future where knowing is obsolete? But that's terrible. We are Homo sapiens. Knowing, that's what distinguishes us from the apes. But look at it this way. It took nature 100 million years to make the ape stand up and become Homo sapiens. It took us only 10,000 to make knowing obsolete. What an achievement that is. But we have to integrate that into our own future. Encouragement seems to be the key. If you look at Kuppam, if you look at all of the experiments that I did, it was simply saying, wow, saluting learning. There is evidence from neuroscience. The reptilian part of our brain, which sits in the center of our brain, when it's threatened, it shuts down everything else. It shuts down the prefrontal cortex, the parts which learn. It shuts all of that down. Punishment and examinations are seen as threats. We take our children, we make them shut their brains down, and then we say, perform. Why did they create a system like that? Because it was needed. There was an age, in the age of empires, when you needed those people who can survive under threat. When you're standing in a trench all alone, if you could have survived, you're okay, you passed. If you didn't, you failed. But the age of empires is gone. What happens to creativity in our age? We need to shift that balance back from threat to pleasure. I came back to England looking for British grandmothers. I put out notices in papers saying, if you're a British grandmother, if you have broadband and a web camera, can you give me 1 hour of your time per week for free? I got 200 in the first 2 weeks. I know more British grandmothers than anyone in the universe. They're called the granny cloud. The granny cloud sits on the internet. If there's a child in trouble, we beam a gran. She goes on over Skype and she sorts things out. I've seen them do it from a village called Diggles in northwestern England, deep inside a village in Tamil Nadu, India, 6,000 miles away. She does it with only one age-old gesture. Okay. Watch this.
You can't catch me. You say it. You can't catch me. I'm the gingerbread man. Well done. Very good.
So what's happening here? I think what we need to look at is we need to look at learning as the product of educational self-organization. If you allow the educational process to self-organize, then learning emerges. It's not about making learning happen, it's about letting it happen. The teacher sets the process in motion, and then she stands back in awe and watches as learning happens. I think that's what all this is pointing at. But how will we know? How will we come to know? Well, I intend to build these self-organized learning environments. They are basically broadband, collaboration, and encouragement put together. I've tried this in many, many schools. It's been tried all over the world. And teachers sort of stand back and say, it just happens by itself? And I said, yeah, it happens by itself. How did you know that? And I said, you won't believe the children who told me and where they're from. Here's a soul in action. This one is in England. He maintains law and order. Because remember, there's no teacher around. Australia.
Giving it a net positive or negative electrical charge. The net charge on an ion is equal to the number of protons in the ion minus the number of electrons.
A decade ahead of a time. So souls, I think we need a curriculum of big questions. You already heard about that. You know what that means. There was a time when Stone Age men and women used to sit and look up at the sky and say, what are those twinkling lights? They built the first curriculum. But we've lost sight of that wondrous questions. We've brought it down to the tangent of an angle. But that's not sexy enough. The way you would put it to a nine-year-old is to say, if a meteorite was coming to hit the Earth, how would you figure out if it was going to or not? And if he says, well, what, how? You say there's a magic word, it's called the tangent of an angle, and leave him alone. He'll figure it out. So here are a couple of images from souls. I've tried incredible questions. When did the world begin? how will it end, to nine-year-olds. This one's about what happens to the air we breathe. This is done by children without the help of any teacher. The teacher only raises the question and then stands back and admires the answer. So, what's my wish? My wish is that we design the future of learning. We don't want to be spare parts for a great human computer, do we? So we need to design a future for learning. And I've got to, hang on, I've got to get this wording exactly right.
Hi there, Justelle. We good?
It's very important. My wish is to help design a future of learning by supporting children all over the world to tap into their wonder and their ability to work together. Help me build this school. It'll be called the School in the Cloud. It'll be a school where children go on these intellectual adventures driven by the big questions which their mediators put in.
Are you hearing me?
The way I want to do this is to build a facility where I can study this. It's a facility which is practically unmanned. There's only one granny who manages health and safety. The rest of it's from the cloud. The lights are turned on and off by the cloud, etc., etc. Everything's done from the cloud.
Are you hearing me?
You for another purpose. You can do self-organized learning environments at home, in the school, outside of school, in clubs. It's very easy to do. There's a great document produced by TED which tells you how to do it. If you would please, please do it across all five continents and send me the data, then I'll put it all together, move it into the School of Clouds, and create the future of learning. That's my wish. And just one last thing. I'll take you to the top of the Himalayas. At 12,000 feet, where the air is thin, I once built two hole-in-the-wall computers, and the children flocked there. There was this little girl who was following me around, and I said to her, you know, I want to give a computer to everybody, every child. I don't know, what should I do? And I was trying to take a picture of her, you know, quietly. She suddenly raised her hand like this and said to me, get on with it. And I think it was good advice. I'll follow her advice.
We will have the full discussion posted on our website. That was a TED conference on a different way of looking at education. And every day this week, we'll be doing a different take on education. Tomorrow, we'll be looking at how creativity has been stripped out of the classroom and what happens to those of us who are creative, who are not interested in the specific type of teaching that's going on, but still want to learn. We're critical thinkers. Where's the room for that? That'll be tomorrow. If you'd like to call in real quick with a comment, you can at 888-874-4888. Joining me in studio right now with your questions, Lou Anne Panessi. She takes the questions from people in the audience, especially when I'm traveling and not able to go to the internet and read the emails. Hi, Lou Anne.
Hello, Gary. If people want to email me, I'm at WHNN, like William, Harry, Nancy, WHNN at AOL.com. And I'm happy to receive your emails, and I get many of them. So here was one that I thought was pretty interesting. This is a person didn't sign their name, but they said, I have a question for you, Gary. He or she said, earlier this evening, I happened to see you and Peter Max having a juice together. And ironically, when I went home to watch Al Jazeera, there was a special on Peter Max. And they asked him how he wanted to be remembered. And he said that he wanted people to think that he brought his own unique type of beauty into the world in his own special way. And I thought to myself, I wish someone would ask you the same question. Do you ever think about that?
No. I don't. For those of us who are very active in addressing creative and social issues, you wake up each day and your full attention is paid to what you're working on. And then once you finish it, then you forget it. I mean, I never think about any of the books, articles, documentaries, specials, investigative reports that I've done. I just, what am I working on today? And I believe that Peter's the same way. I've known Peter a long time. We're good friends. And he's one of the gifted artists that have left us so much joy from his artwork. And that's how Peter wants to be remembered, for what he brought in touching people in a good way. I think the larger message is each and every one of us has a moral, a spiritual responsibility to leave a legacy that shows that we cared enough about others, that we touched them in a way that inspired them, motivated them, helped them when they needed that help, were kind to them, and showed we came from an unconditional loving place. I don't think you could live a life that manifested a destiny any better than that. What we do that's specific is unique to our own personalities and our own interest. So living each day in a meaningful way and caring as much about others as you do yourself, I think that's the way that I live, and I hope other people in this audience, and I know they do, they care about other people as well.
Okay.
Thank you. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on an upcoming program. Just one quick announcement on that. In another week, we're starting a 3-month intensive health support group that will be meeting once a week for 3 hours to deal with the following conditions: diabetes, overweight conditions, high blood pressure, and elevated cholesterol. If you have any of those or all of those, you can contact Luann, see if you can qualify to get in. And our goal is to use lifestyle and behavior modification with some brand new protocols I've created to help people improve the quality of their life. Luann, your phone number?
Yes, it's 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198. Give me a call. If you get my answering machine, no worries. I will get back to you within 24 hours.
Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice. Do we have Utrice there? Hi, Utrice. No, Utrice is not online right now. She will be in a few moments. And by the way, Luann, we want to make sure that if we have too many people signing up, we'll just do 2 classes in a night. So instead of starting at 7 o'clock and go to 10, we'll start a little earlier for the first class. And though there will be, and I want to make this clear, we're not taking anyone off their medications. They'll still see their physicians. And my hope is their physician will monitor them and see that their blood pressure is becoming normal, their cholesterol is coming down, especially the LDLs, their homocysteine levels are correcting, and their weight is dropping, their blood sugar is normalizing, and let their doctor see this. My hope is the doctor will be motivated to want to know more, because historically, with the 30,000 people that have been in the previous 42 health support groups, I've yet to see a doctor call me and say, you know something? My patient changed radically, more than what I could do. What'd you do?
That would be a miracle.
We've never had that happen, not once. So, anyhow, you all have a nice day. Tonight, 7 o'clock, I've got a really, really important program on how the rest of the world perceives America for its domestic and foreign policies and how we've impacted some of the people who are going to be on the air in South America. For example, our war on drugs from a leading academic professor who lived in Colombia, who tells us the truth about what happened there and how many lives it cost, how much poverty. The people who are running the war on drugs, they make a lot of money, have a lot of power. The people who are impacted, it's a different story. You won't want to miss this. Have a nice day.